Today is Thursday, February 2nd, 2023. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Frank Barrios, and Frank spells his last name B-A-R-R-I-O-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Frank. How are you today?
Good morning. Doing well.
Great. Good to hear it. Frank, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. You and I were just talking now, and you had recalled another hike in the canyon that you hadn't mentioned already, and could you pick that up?
Yes, Chiaba Falls. I had almost forgotten it. This was many years ago, but it was CL, an old high school buddy of his, Dave Peters, who was one of the group's hikers, and an engineer who worked with me at the Department of Water Resources, Don Gross. And the four of us decided to go see Chiaba Falls, and it would have been in the spring, so it would have been running.
Okay.
And
this would have been in the 70s or 80s or 90s? When was this?
Yeah, probably the... No, it would not have been in the 90s. This was early... Dave Peters is dead already. This would have been probably the 70s.
Okay.
And we started on the South Rim, went down to Phantom Ranch, and then followed the trail along the Colorado to, I think that's Clear Creek, isn't it?
That's right.
And then we dropped down into Clear Creek, and there's a camp there, that at least the designated place to camp, and we camped there as soon as you got off of the along the trail. We dropped down into Clear Creek, spent the night, and the next morning we got up early and went all the way up to Chiaba Falls, and I took a lot of pictures of it. And then
was it running?
It's what now?
Was it running?
Oh yeah, that's why we timed it to make. We would be there when it was running.
Okay.
Just another side deal that you may find, but at another time, I know CL came from the, what's that trail that, it's east of the North Kaibab. What's that first trail?
Nakweep? The Nakweep Trail?
No, this is on the South Rim.
Tanner or Grandview. Or...
I think it was Tanner.
Okay.
And he went down the Tanner, down to the Colorado, and with his little boat, he crossed the river. And he got to that Clear Creek from that side.
Yes, okay.
That was one of CL's trips. I remember it because he was talking about it. He went to the mine. There's an asbestos mine down there somewhere.
Yeah, the Hance asbestos mine, sure.
Yeah, and he checked it out and then went down to the river, crossed it, and then went over to Clear Creek.
Okay.
But anyway, ours was just a... Now, one of the things that always stays with me, and I should have remembered this because of nothing else, I tore a tendon in my leg in that trip. It was at the bottom. And because the legs, it's interesting because I didn't fall or anything. I was just hiking. All of a sudden, I felt somebody had stuck a knife in my calf below, and it swelled up. And I later found out I had torn a
your Achilles tendon area.
Yeah, well, it wasn't the main one.
Okay.
It was one of the lesser tendons that that you walk on.
Okay.
But the leg swelled up. I didn't dare take my shoe off. I was at the bottom of the canyon, but I had a hiking stick, and I used that stick to, like you would use a crutch, and I hiked all the way out of the canyon to the top. But that was a great trip, and I really enjoyed seeing Chiaba Falls.
Nice. Very good. Did any of you actually try to scramble up sort of toward the cave? It's very hard to get to.
No, we didn't.
Okay.
Not that trip. It's later years. This was an early trip.
Okay.
So maybe before CL was going everywhere.
Okay. All right.
But we all just from the bottom took pictures. We didn't get up to where the water was coming out of the canyon.
And so you were able to hike out with a torn tendon, and then that healed up just fine?
Oh, yeah. No, I got home, and I got a crutch, and I was on a crutch for a while. The doctor said the tendon would just assimilate.
Uh-huh.
They didn't do anything. He just said let it heal, and over time it would assimilate into the body, and the swelling would come down, and you'd be all right. And he was right.
Mm-hmm. Great.
It took time. It took months.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was walking around with a crutch for about a couple of months. But finally, it healed just like the doctor said, and I was okay.
Nice. Okay.
It wasn't a major. It was one of the minor. I didn't even know there was more than one, but he said there was a tendon. A major, one of the major ones that had torn.
Okay.
But it was not the major one, but it was enough to hurt a lot, and of course the leg just swelled up, and I didn't dare take my shoe off because then I couldn't put it back on.
You know, Frank, one of the things we haven't talked about yet, thinking about this, and you've written a couple books, and one is on the Hispanics or Mexicans in Phoenix. The other one is about St. Vincent de Paul, and I don't think we've talked about your relationship with St. Vincent de Paul. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I started with St. Vincent de Paul in the late 1980s. One of my people that was working for me was a longtime member of St. Vincent de Paul, and he said, "We could really use somebody to speak Spanish in the area we've been bringing food."
Mm.
And I said, "Sure, I'll give my Saturdays up." But that was just like the canyon. Once you start it, you can't quit it.
Oh, cool.
So I got into it, and I really enjoyed what they were doing. And little by little, I became more involved. And
what were they doing back there in the 1980s when you first started volunteering?
Well, primarily the basic tendon of St. Vincent Paul is to provide food.
Okay.
We have feeding centers in many locations. Within the Diocese of Phoenix, which is, and we also at every Catholic, not everyone, we were in about 80 Catholic churches where they had a St. Vincent de Paul, and in those churches we would go out. People would call us and say, "I need food." We would deliver food to their home.
Okay.
And if they needed help with rent or utilities, we would interview them, and then we would help them if we had the money, depending on which parish you were in. Some of them were richer than others. But then we started the program as time went on that the richer parishes would provide money to the poorer parishes and help them pay the costs of running those conferences.
Okay.
And I can this was many years now. I'm the immediate past president of the board of directors for St. Vincent de Paul, and so I'm trying to. It was sometime 2000 something to about 2020, I think, is when I served a term as president, and then I stepped down, and I was the last president. There's a new president right now, and I saw where St. Vincent Paul was struggling in those early years to get by, and but I also watched us grow. And today, St. Vincent Paul's in 150 countries in the world.
Okay.
And we have a headquarters for St. Vincent de Paul in Paris, France.
Okay.
And they're not under the bishop or the diocese. This is a separate Catholic worldwide organization. And we're all over the United States, New York, Los Angeles, everywhere. And today, right now, St. Vincent de Paul in Phoenix is the largest, most successful St. Vincent de Paul in the world.
Okay.
And we just, in my book, you'll see the world president came to visit us and wanted to know how you're so successful. He was a man from Brazil.
And how do you attribute that success? How do you see that?
There's several answers because at one time we were struggling, but one of them is the director Steve Zabilski. He's you have to allot a lot to him. He built relationships with all the big companies in Phoenix. And we're very effective in what we do. And then unwritten goal for St. Vincent de Paul is no form of charity is foreign to St. Vincent de Paul.
Hmm.
And that means that wherever we're needed, we'll go in and do it. The only exception is we don't give money to somebody else to do it. We have to do it ourselves.
Okay.
And we're very effective at doing it. And I think it was recognized by most of the companies. And Zabilski, example, we tried to give them a raise because we're like a $40 million a year operation. We're
okay.
A huge. And he won't accept it. He said he didn't vote it in. So he's in comparison with other $40 million operations, Zabilski is way underpaid.
Mm-hmm.
But he just... This year he stepped down, and his assistant took over, Shannon Clancy. But also know you've heard of the Pulliam Trust.
Yes.
Well, the Pulliam Trust, a few years back, decided to give us a multi-million-dollar grant.
Okay.
But not to spend as you want. The grant said, we're going to set you up so into create a fundraising operation for you.
Okay.
And I can tell you that also made a big difference.
Okay.
What they did is they brought in, with their money, not ours,
mm-hmm.
they brought in an expert from New York City to set up this fundraising group. And they paid for them for about 3 years. They hired people to fill these positions, created a fundraising group, did things like all our trucks now have a big picture of a child or somebody with their hand out asking for money, all of this, what most fundraisers do. But they also created this fundraising team. And when they were done, they used up the entire amount to create this. And today, that fundraising group is bringing in millions of dollars to St. Vincent de Paul.
Okay.
And of course, they're paying their salaries 10 times over by what they're doing. And that was on this gift that we got from the Pulliam Trust. But also, we're very effective in what we do. And we have dedicated individuals. I think one of the big pluses is that we treat our employees very well. They get more than minimum wage. They, when we're doing well, we give them bonuses. I don't think there's an employee that works for St. Vincent de Paul that's dissatisfied with the way they're treated.
Nice.
And the end result is unbelievable loyalty to St. Vincent de Paul.
Yes.
And all of this, and give you an example right now with the homeless situation. I mentioned to you earlier that we were primarily feeding people. Well, all of a sudden, you got homeless everywhere. So St. Vincent de Paul decided to get into the homeless situation, and we had what we called Osmond Manor for years, which we sort of a transitional housing from street to back to society, and we would house.
What's that first word, Frank? What's the name of the manor?
Frederick Osmond was the founder of St. Vincent de Paul, 1833 in Paris, France.
Okay.
He founded St. Vincent de Paul. And so this was called Osmond Manor.
Okay.
O-Z-N-A-M-N. Osmond Manor. And it was named after Frederick Osmond, who was the founder of St. Vincent de Paul. Basically, he was rich, but said, you know what? I'm a Catholic. My faith is important, but, you know, we got to do more than just give money or attend church every Sunday. We got to get involved with the poor. And he got some other rich people and went out to where the poor were and started providing service to them. And that's how St. Vincent de Paul got started. And he named it after St. Vincent de Paul.
Nice.
And
So was that shelters then? Did you actually start, you know, buildings and places for people to stay? And
that's correct. In fact, this year alone, we just finished, when I was president, we just finished it. We built an addition to Osmond Manor. We had one already. We rented some facilities in Phoenix to house transitional housing, it was called. And we decided to build one on our property, and we just finished that last year. And now, because of the increased demand, we're building a brand new one right next to it.
Wow.
And I'll give you an example of how we operate. The immigrants who were pouring in, what the feds were doing, because there was piling up at the border. They were bringing immigrants from the border who were undocumented immigrants and dropping them off at the bus depot in downtown Phoenix.
Oh, okay.
These were people who couldn't speak English, had no money, but somehow the feds just dropped them off and they were piling up outside of the bus depot. Well, St. Vincent de Paul found out. We went and got them and brought them to our facility, and we where we feed. We have several feeding centers, but the main one is on. We have a couple of very, very large feeding centers, but the main one is on Watkins, and we brought those people there. And every night we would take the tables down, put cots on the area, and put these people up overnight. And then the next morning, we'd take the cots down, put the tables back, and go back to feeding people. And it was just temporary until we could get them into the county, I think it was Ott School. They had an old abandoned school. They started putting these people up until they could find a place for them.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this was we're primarily known for feeding. And all of a sudden, taking down our dining tables and putting in cots at night, and then going back to feeding people at night. And again, no form of charity is foreign to St. Vincent de Paul.
Cool.
Whatever we can do to alleviate, we do it ourselves. And then the latest thing is. We have a stellar reputation. That's one of the reasons for the main success. But the latest thing, the city of Phoenix owns a large building, and they contracted with us to provide the people to serve. It's not an overnight place. It's when it gets real hot and people die, a lot of them homeless diet during the summer here.
Oh, to make a cooling shelter.
Yeah, it was a temporary housing shelter, and we've agreed to house it with people that we will hire.
Okay.
And so And then we're in the process right now of building a second Osna Manor that will be completed probably during this year.
Okay.
And but this is just an example of St. Vincent Paul and so many very loyal volunteers. We also have the largest volunteer program anywhere in Phoenix. So we have a lot of very dedicated people that serve and help. I'll give you one example. If you read my book, it's in there, but the Jewish community under Rabbi Plotkin, what he would bring several Jewish members from his church at Christmas time, and he would all the employees and so on that celebrate Christmas, he would send them home, and the Jewish community would serve the homeless because Christmas is not one of their holidays, and
right.
That would allow our employees and our volunteers to spend Christmas with their families.
Nice.
And the Jewish community served the poor. And he's dead now, but Rabbi Plotkin was one of the strongest supporters of St. Vincent Paul, as was Eddie Basha. Eddie Basha, the Basha Stores.
You bet.
He was a huge supporter of St. Vincent Paul. He provided lots of funds for a lot of the work that we did.
Nice. And are you, St. Vincent Paul, not you, but the organization, looking for, given that there must be a food warehouse, and then looking for food that is still perfectly edible from the, the community, the greater Phoenix.
Any day that you come to our main headquarters on Watkins,
mm-hmm.
there'll be these great semi-trucks backing up from Safeway, all the major stores, and they provide us with food that it's still good.
Yes.
But it's they feel that if they try to sell them, they'll eventually reach the date. So rather than do that, they give us, like example, if one can in a case is damaged,
right.
they give us the whole case. And on any given day, the semis are backed up at our main feeding center on Watkins, and
mm-hmm.
they're unloading trucks full of food, which we then put into categories, and then each conference being the St. Vincent de Paul that's in the parish, the church, Catholic church, they come and we give them an allotment of food, and they take that allotment and they give it out to the poor.
Great. Yep.
And then we also recently, the county manager for Maricopa County retired and came to work for us, and the first thing he wanted to do was create an urban farm.
Okay.
And he's got one of the most successful urban farms there on our property with ASU students coming and working with them. And,
nice.
We grow a lot of our own food that we give to the poor now. And we've got like three or four urban farms throughout the valley.
What a great
where
idea.
We're growing our own crops. And then recently the black sports announcer for Channel 12 just retired. I can't think of his name. He came to work for us to provide the knowledge of videotaping everything we're doing. And Channel 12, 10, all the TV channels cover us regularly and give us a lot of support.
Nice. Very nice.
Well, it was a life-changing event for me when I got involved with St. Vincent de Paul.
Nice. Very good. Yeah, and you'd mentioned that a number of times, so I'm like, I guess I need to ask Frank about that.
Oh.
Because it's clearly very important to you, and you've done amazing work there. So thank you for that. What else? What have we left out here?
Well, I think I also I was one of the first people when it got started. I don't know if you've heard of the Kino Border Initiative.
Tell me about it.
It's a group of Jesuits out of Southern California that observed they would get undocumented immigrants, arrest them or whatever, they hold them, and then they would bring them to the Nogales border and in a bus and send them back to Mexico.
Okay.
And but it was creating a dilemma in that these people were coming across back to Mexico, and they didn't have any money. Some of the women were pregnant. Some of the were sick, and it was just a disaster. They were just being dumped and sent to Mexico.
Hmm.
So they created what they call the Kino Border Initiative, which in Mexico, but again, it was started by Jesuits in Southern California, and they created a consortium of Mexican Catholic priests and nuns from Mexico, plus the Jesuits from Southern California, and they created this Kino Border Initiative, which provided food for these immigrants. It provided a clinic for those that were sick, and it provided a woman's shelter for those women that had been abused or were pregnant or whatever the situation was. But the only problem with it is it was at three different locations in Mexico.
Okay.
You go to one location for food, another location for the clinic, and they leased three floors of an apartment building in Mexico, Nogales, Sonora, for the women. they were getting funding, and they decided to build their own facility in Mexico where everything could be under one roof.
Okay.
And that was dedicated I believe it was last year or this year, I can't remember, but we dedicated the building, and they have a brand new building within, I don't know, a quarter of a mile from the border with the United States. So as soon as you cross the border into Mexico, there's the new facility that was built. And they are going full speed right now. But to add to the problems of where at one time it was dedicated just to people that were coming back from the United States, but now the border is clogged with people from all over the world.
Right.
That are coming. And you've got people from Venezuela, Cuba, Europe, everywhere. And so they're having to try to open the doors a little bit more to try to resolve the issue, or at least to help the people. And I was very involved in that when they got started, when they first, back in the, probably around 2000 or something. It's a fairly new organization. And I've been involved with them all that time. And then I also served as president of the Pioneer Cemetery Association, which is a group that partners with the city of Phoenix on our pioneer cemeteries. We have the two cemeteries the city of Phoenix owns that were, one was indigent and the other was it wasn't the first, but it was pretty close. It's called the Pioneer Cemetery of Phoenix. And buried there is Daryl Dupa, the Lost Dutchman.
Mm-hmm.
The Lost Dutchman is buried there. The mayor, first mayors of Phoenix are buried there. And this group partners with the city of Phoenix, and they do research on the people who are buried there and make certain Phoenix keeps everything clean. The other cemetery Phoenix owns was an indigent cemetery abandoned many years ago. There's probably about 10,000 people buried there.
Okay.
We now, with this partnership with the City of Phoenix, we do a lot of research and get involved in cemeteries throughout Arizona. And the latest project I was involved in, and I'm still involved in, is we discovered a Mexican-American cemetery on 12th Street and Broadway called the Sotelo Herd. And it's owned by a 501c trellis. But I've been working on it now probably 15 years, maybe 20 years.
Super.
Trying to get this cemetery into the hands of the City of Phoenix.
Ah, good.
But it's been a real, we know for certain, we've done some research on it, and we know there's the names of the people. There's about 308 people buried there that we know their names. Maybe as high as 400 would be buried there.
Okay.
It was a very poor Mexican cemetery. If you go there, you just see a vacant lot. You don't even know there's anybody buried there.
Wow. Huh.
The headstones have been stolen, and we're trying to get it into the City of Phoenix, but they've resisted, and it's been a big battle. Pioneer Cemetery's involved in this also.
Okay. Frank, remember the second interview you and I did? We jumped from 30,000 feet up to 100,000 feet and talked about water in Arizona. I wanted to do that for just a minute with the Kino Border Initiative, and if you and I were up at 100,000 feet looking globally at migration, what are some of the things you've learned and you've seen that you know, because I think of one facility, even a big facility in Nogales, Sonora, would be overrun with not only people being moved back out of the United States, but people showing up at the border trying to go into the United States. I kind of was just curious on what some of your thoughts are on how to deal with the larger issue of global migration.
I don't have an answer, by the way, but
okay.
But I can tell you this. The whole Southwest, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but there's two situations we face. And there's one major source of water for both Mexico, northern Mexico, I should say, Sonora, is the Colorado River. And for years when I was working, we always thought the Colorado River would always have a large flow of water and that we could count on it and would probably could be managed and provide any disasters. And all of a sudden, we enter a drought, and both Hoover and Glen Canyon have been down to the bottom. Now, there's two possible scenarios. One is that if you believe in climate change, this is going to continue. If it continues, the Southwest is going to be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They won't have enough water. And that includes Mexico, California, Arizona, Las Vegas, and even some of the upper basin states. The Colorado River flows through seven states.
Right.
And it's to reach the ocean. Well, the other option is maybe this is just temporary and we'll have wet years again. If that occurs, then if it's temporary and the reservoirs fill up again, they got huge amounts of. One thing most people don't realize, if you take the entire Colorado River, there's about 62 million acre-feet of storage, and 50 million of that 62 lies behind Hoover and Glen Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
So if the water, if we're not in a change of climate, and the wet years will return, then you've got 15 million acre feet of storage that you can store water behind those two dams. It's almost the entire storage of the Colorado River. But if it is a climate change, and we're over allocated already. When we did the allocation, it was based on wet years of the Colorado River. So we gave more water to people than we had to give away.
Right. No, and Frank, I'm sorry. I wasn't because we talked about this in part two about just water and water management. I was thinking more about the Keno Border Initiative trying to get a clinic and shelter and food to immigrants who are trying to come to the United States for a better life. I totally get that. That's my heritage. That's your heritage. It's all of our heritage, going back till the indigenous days, you know, where people were coming to the New World for a new life. And you mentioned you don't have an answer for that, and maybe that's it for this. I'm just thinking about
well, but know also this is interesting, is that Mexico has a water problem also.
Okay.
Not just the United States.
Right.
And
well, many countries around the world are experiencing drought now badly.
Oh, absolutely. And let me give you an example. I don't know if you keep up with the article in the paper the other day. Governor Ducey put together a water group, and they wanted to hire. They haven't, and I hope they don't. But they hired a private company to build a desalinization plant in Rocky Point.
Okay.
And their plan was one to take desalinated water from Rocky Point all the way up to Buckeye, pipe it.
Okay.
And then, but also part of the plan was to build a pipeline from that desalinated plant to Nogales, Sonora, and to Hermosillo, Sonora.
Okay.
Which both are hurting for water.
Hmm.
So it's interesting. It isn't going to go forward, but the interesting thing was that they were proposing a pipeline from Rocky Point, a desalinized water, to Nogales, Sonora, and to Hermosillo, Sonora.
Mm-hmm.
I had mentioned before, Mexico, by treaty, gets 1.5 million acre feet at Yuma for Mexicali area.
Right.
And San Luis. But most people don't realize Tijuana is also a dry place.
Mm-hmm.
San Diego has real water problems.
Right.
But in Tijuana, they have a desalting plant, my understanding. I'm not sure where it is or anything. But again, one of the only areas left for if you want to grow and if you got people coming in that have to have water, it's going to be desalinization, bringing the converting ocean water, but that's got a lot of issues. One is it's very expensive, and two is there's huge environmental impacts from, like that company I mentioned to you.
Mm-hmm.
Their plan was to take, when you desalinize the seawater, you get tons and tons of salt.
Right, lots of brine.
What do you do with
it? Right.
And their plan is to take it to the ocean and dump it in the ocean.
Ooh.
Bad plan. Environmentally, fish would start dying.
Exactly. But, too salty. Yeah.
But that's a cheaper plan than putting it in a truck and hauling it somewhere where you can find a place that nobody, because you'll build mountains of salt in no time.
Yeah.
And the big cost of trucks hauling that salt away is where a big part of the cost of desalinization comes. But that is the only answer for new water.
Well, it seems as though the drought, in as you mentioned, in Mexico globally, is just fueling the migration because people can't live where there's no water and no food, no water for livestock. So then they start moving. Yeah, and that kind of compounds the whole issue.
And the big problem is most of Arizona is on groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a one-time source.
Right.
When it's gone, it's gone.
That's right.
And you got Cayman, Prescott, Payson, Flagstaff. Those cities can't grow because if they get much bigger, they're going to use up all the water they're using,
mm.
and they got nowhere else to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get the immigrants coming in. Everybody's pouring into Arizona right now, and they're buying up what you're seeing is the tip of the iceberg at Rio Verde. I don't know if you just saw what they were doing in Mojave County. Arab country was growing alfalfa in Mojave County.
You bet.
And,
bundling
and,
it up and shipping it over for their cattle, for their dairy industry. Yeah. Amazing. So, I think of St. Vincent de Paul and, Border Initiative. These are excellent services that are desperately needed. But I kind of think of them as using a water analogy as a drop in the bucket for the global need. So I look to someone like you with 80 years of life to kind of stand back and look and give some thoughts about that.
Well, all you can do is the humanitarian thing, make sure people don't die of starvation or
right.
Being out in the cold. But how do you solve the problem of poor people pouring in across the border?
Mm.
If it was Nazi Germany, they'd be shooting them right now.
Right.
But that isn't what we do as human beings. And we want to help these people, but how do you help them? We're talking about thousands and thousands of people migrating with their children.
Millions,
when
yeah.
When you have a mother with three little kids crossing the border into the United States, what do you do with her?
You bet.
And it's a huge problem, and there's no silver bullet.
Mm.
Unless if you poured billions and billions of dollars, that plan I told you about the Rocky Point,
yeah,
that was to bring water. That the cost of that plan was hit at $5 billion.
Is that right? Okay.
And with the high cost of everything, trying to help people becomes very expensive.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And right now with the split you have between Republicans and Democrats, I don't know where you get the money to do this.
Mm-hmm. That's
and,
right.
I wish there were a silver bullet somewhere, but I just would share with you one thing, because I'm also a historian, but I remember reading one time, where Casa Grande is and the prehistoric structure outside of Coolidge?
Yes.
Well, the Hohokam did not build high-rises or adobe structures, and they said that there was evidence that the Pueblo Indians moved in and actually were living peacefully side by side with the Hohokam.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hohokam learned from the Pueblo Indians about design of like these structures like that. And they say Casa Grande was probably influenced by these Pueblo Indians that were living side by side peacefully with the Hohokam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it makes you think of the border, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Where people are crossing the border, but there's so many people that are so opposed to anybody coming into crossing the border. Like the farmers, they can't survive without immigrants because nobody wants to work the fields. It's
right.
hard work.
Right.
And then to make things worse, it's not about solving problems anymore. It's about winning and losing on policies that the government, Republicans and Democrats each have their policies and they want to get them done, but You know, it used to be at a time when people would look at things and say, well, let's try to solve the problem.
Right.
Like I just saw Kavanaugh pass the legislation. Here we are with water problems, problems with the schools. And what he was passing laws on is whether a child should be called Jimmy or Janie, which would be different from what he was born his natural birth. But again, we should be trying to solve these problems instead of philosophy and policies, but that ain't where we're at.
Right, looking at the bigger issues. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Frank. That was very helpful to kind of capture that larger vision. And as you mentioned, there is no silver bullet here. It's there's some very, very complex issues all around. So, yeah. You mentioned the Pioneer Cemetery Association. Anything else you wanted to visit with?
It's what now?
Anything else you want to bring into this interview?
I think I belong to a lot of groups after I retired. And the other one was First Families of Arizona. They've been around since the 1930s. And again, like you mentioned, it was just a more social club, but they, families that came to Arizona before 1912.
Right.
And as you rightfully stated, it would be open to any Native American, but mostly it was mostly Anglo, but also Mexicans. One black is there, but it's open to nobody. There's no discrimination. Anybody can join that wants to.
Yeah.
And but it's and we give presentations every month, and we go from September through May, and then closed down during the summer. And they've been around since the 1930s. In fact, they at one time had a museum, which ended up going to the Phoenix Museum of History. I also was the last president of the Phoenix Museum of History.
Okay.
And when they closed down because we couldn't get enough support to stay alive. And I was the last president, and right now all those artifacts are locked up at the closed museum owned by the Science Center.
Okay.
And the Science Center is doing great. They have people lined up very successful, but the history is not what people want to hear about, I guess.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm quite sure.
I also served on the Arizona Historical Society board, I served a full term at them.
Okay.
I think the one thing is probably the highest, if you will, was my time on the Central Arizona Project Board of Directors, which was from 2003 to 2006. And then I ran and lost. I mentioned that before.
Yes.
But that's an elected position, and it's important in that they oversee the flow of the Colorado River into, it's a separate organization. If you want to compare it to somebody, it'd be like the Salt River Project.
Okay.
And they oversee the delivery, make sure the water is delivered to the people, contracts, but they don't own it because the water is overseen by the federal government. The Bureau of Reclamation holds the contracts, but they give the contracts to people and they get the water. And in many cases right now, like the Native Americans were given large sums of the Colorado River water, and they are in the process of trying to lease that water to others who would pay more for it. Right. And I also was a member and both the commission and the foundation of our statehood when we turned 100 years. Governor Napolitano appointed me to the commission and to the foundation.
Nice. For the centennial of Arizona statehood?
Correct.
Yeah. A quick question for you about historians. The joke is historians argue with one another over events they did not see and were not at. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not a history major. I'm an engineer. from a historic family that has roots just like Barry Goldwater and the Udalls.
Mm-hmm.
My family goes way back here in Arizona, and I love the state, and thank God every day that I was born here. And
nice.
Proud to be American, and proud and happy, and thank God for my legacy, my family, Mexican-American roots, and being born in Arizona with all the opportunities that are here. But you're exactly right. And one of the ways I look at history, and nobody else probably does, but it's like you got a puzzle on the wall, and you have a piece here, and you have another piece over here, but you never have the whole picture. You just have little pieces that are out there. And if you try to make judgment based on one little piece, you're probably going to miss. But if you stand back and look at it and you say, you know, in this empty spot here, I know what happened later. I know what happened before. Maybe I can fill it out. And pretty soon you get the idea of a picture of what was occurring.
Mm-hmm.
But what too many people end up doing, they take something with history and then they make a whole program out of one event in history.
Hmm.
And what is the truth? That's the other big problem, is because everybody lies at one point or another.
Yeah.
Earl Zarbin, who is a good friend of mine, still alive, but Earl would always say, and I would always argue with him because I said, no, this can't be. He said he never believed people. He would only, his facts were based on the newspaper. I said, well, the newspaper lies a lot too, Earl.
Uh-huh.
That's not the truth. But the other thing is, there's another saying about the winners write history.
Yes.
And it could, like, I could give you thousands and thousands of reports of people that we classify as heroes that were some of the rottenest people on earth.
Right.
Because they were Anglo-Saxon, because D.A.R. Found out that their parents fought in the American Revolution,
mm-hmm.
They elevate them to some high position. And in reality, they were not the greatest people in the world, but Charles Poston is one of them, called the father of Arizona. He was a drunk, died in the street, passed out in the streets of Phoenix drunk.
Hmm.
He abandoned his wife and child and worked for the mining company, and the only reason he became our representative when he became a territory was because the mines put him in there.
Oh, interesting.
His body lies in a pyramid on top of a hill outside of Florence with all kinds of... recently, we started changing the names of schools that were named after members of the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
And that's an example. King Woolsey, one of the state legislators, was a terrible person. But again, was he one of the first pioneers in Arizona? Yeah, he was, but not a very nice man, and very bigoted. Indians and blacks were not human beings. They were people to be killed. But again, you know, how you, the truth doesn't get told in history books necessarily. And the truth, you know, if you're Native American, the Aravaipa massacre.
Right.
Where there's a good example of atrocities, but yet you don't hear much about that.
Right.
And it,
because the winners wrote the history.
That's correct. That's correct. And the truth, are not necessarily willing to accept it. I always like when there's some ladies in the room and they kind of frown. I said, you know, women over history have sanitized history. And it's true. If you're a mother and you've got children, are you going to tell them your father was a no-good womanizer that killed people? No, you're going to tell me he was the greatest person on earth. And a lot of our history, not only written by men, but sanitized by women. Women have a tendency of the DAR is a good example. They've done some. They're not like they used to be, but they are making changes now, trying to look at the bigger picture. But back a few years ago, they were, if you were an Anglo, they were almost right next up there with the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, interesting.
Now, these are my thoughts, anyway.
Thank you.
Again, opinion.
Thank you.
Versus somebody else's opinion.
Exactly. But no. That's exactly what I was looking for, was your thoughts, and that's lovely. That's very helpful. Because your thoughts are long viewed. You have a long vision, so that's very helpful.
And the other, I'll just end it with one thought.
Please.
A lot of the universities tend to go crazy over one little bit of information, and because they have evidence on it. Well, who's looking at the big picture of what happened?
Right.
And I clash with a lot of the university people because, they have to be absolutely crystal clear, perfect, and they concentrate on one little tiny bit of history, and they have this evidence behind it, and only speak of absolutes.
Mm.
Well, but then who's talking about the history of the people? Who's talking about what occurred? And so I often, and again, I'm not a historian, I'm an engineer. And of course, a historian could write documents on one piece of paper they found somewhere.
Mm. Oh, gosh, so many interesting things. I just think of, there's so many sides to every story. And if we focus on one side, then we miss the richness of what is our past.
Exactly.
I kind of ponder that. And of course, today with digital cameras, large archives where, as you say, one letter would be scrutinized. Well, now there's a million letters, and that makes a different vision, a much more rich, I think, tapestry of history, with all its ins and outs and ups and downs and stories that didn't seem to make sense over here that actually related to issues over there that we missed.
Another good example is the sheriff of Phoenix, Enrique Garfias, Mexican.
Okay.
Well, he was loved by both sides because he was like Wyatt Earp.
Mm.
But yet not a word was ever written about him in the history books.
Oh, interesting.
And until recently, they came out with a book on his life. But the guy was, they even at one point, and remember, Phoenix didn't get started till 20 years after the war with Mexico. There was nothing here when Mexico claimed the Phoenix area, but after the war with Mexico, the Gila River was the northern boundary of the southern boundary of what they had won, and then later they purchased the Gadsden Purchase, which brought everything to where we are today.
Right,
but Garfias And there were several Mexicans, even though that settled and started Phoenix, even though it wasn't a city for 20 years after the war with Mexico. And yet very little was ever written on the, but then later the railroad came in, people came from the South, and they all brought their bigotry, their culture to Phoenix, and the Mexicans went from half the population of Phoenix to become minorities, and then laws were passed. Ku Klux Klan started elevating, and you had huge discrimination against Mexicans, mm-hmm. Chinese, Catholics, everybody else.
You bet. You bet. Yep. We as a species can be very, can be very hostile toward our own species for any number of odd reasons.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been a lovely interview series.
I agree. I thank you for doing this, and like I said, I appreciate it, deeply do, because if we don't do this, the people that are interested in history and what has happened, it gets lost. Every year, somebody that was part of our history dies.
Yes.
And their history dies with them. If you don't do what you're doing, a lot of our history will be lost, and then people will be guessing of what happened. And so I appreciate, for one, thank you for what you're doing.
Well, you're very kind. I feel very fortunate to have an opportunity to do this, to meet so many amazing people like yourself, and to learn about their lives and their struggles and their victories. And it's a wonderful thing. So thank you so very much for your participation today. Hang on a second. I'm just going to close this out. This will conclude part 6 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Frank Barrios. Today is Thursday, February 2nd, 2023. My name is Tom Martin. And Frank, thank you so very, very much for your willingness to do this.
Thank you for what you're doing.